This edition of Monocle on Saturday was first broadcast on the 9th of March, 2024. Hello, I'm Vincent McAvinney, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday. You're very welcome wherever you are tuning in around the world. Coming up on today's programme, we have a look through the week's news and culture with Yasmin Abdelmajid, Sudanese-Australian writer and broadcaster. Yasmin, what's caught your eye?
So we have a couple of different stories, one looking at the UN Security Council voting for a Ramadan ceasefire in Sudan, looking at whether a TikTok ban might actually go ahead in the US this time, and some fun stuff about space.
Oh, that sounds great. I do absolutely love a space story. But back here on Earth, of course, this is also Oscar weekend, and we're going to hear from the man in charge.
None of this exhausts me. It's thrilling. It's exhilarating. I feel like the industry, the filmmaking community is all sort of moving towards the Oscars throughout the year.
Monocle's Thomas Lewis speaks to the CEO of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences ahead of tomorrow's big event. Plus, the director of the London Book Fair, Gareth Rapley, joins us to talk about the upcoming event, as well as the latest trends in the global book market. Well, hello and welcome to Monocle on Saturday. It's been a busy week in geopolitics. In the United States, Super Tuesday confirmed what had long been suspected. 2024 would be a Biden-Trump rematch. Nikki Haley, the final failed Republican candidate, refused to endorse her former boss, but the majority of the Republican Congressional Party, many of whose lives came under threat on January the 6th under Trump's insurrectionist orders, all simply fell in line. Never before has an American election starting gun been fired so early. And on Thursday night, President Biden used his third and possibly final State of the Union to address Congress as the effective launch of his re-election campaign. Given the state of the world, though, his address took an uncharacteristic international tone for the occasion, pledging unwavering support for Ukraine, chastising Trump for encouraging Putin, and promising to build a new port in Gaza to facilitate aid deliveries. Sitting in the gallery as a guest of President Biden was Sweden's Prime Minister, leader of NATO's newest member state, officially confirmed that day. A nation abandoning two centuries-old policy of neutrality, just one of the unexpected consequences of President Putin's illegal invasion. Meanwhile, in Germany, a nation trying to reignite its military prowess in the wake of that aggression, they learned an embarrassing lesson in secure communications after allowing a sensitive call between top brass to be hacked. The leaked audio revealing operational secrets of allies Britain and France to much consternation, another blow for Olaf Scholz's wobbling government. And in Britain itself, the Conservative government delivered what is likely to be their last budget after 14 years in power. With a nation in recession and living standards frozen at or below 2008 levels, it seems like the five prime ministers they've burnt through have only managed to conserve a low-growth economy. But in Beijing's Hall of the People, the CCP promised 5% economic growth as they try to correct a post-pandemic hangover, a simmering property bubble, and burgeoning youth unemployment. You only have to look at Europe to see over the past 16 years how much that can radicalise a population against its leaders, perhaps even in a one-state system. Just some of the stories we've been covering this week here on Monocle Radio, and they're dominating the papers this weekend too. Well, I'm pleased to say I'm joined in the studio by Yasmin Abdelmajid, Sudanese-Australian writer and broadcaster. Yasmin, what have you been up to lately?
Well, I just came back from Monocle listeners who are regular listeners will know that I was going to go to a wedding in Pakistan. So I'm back from the wedding in Pakistan. I had all the requisite outfits. There was a series of outfits that were color-coded that I took. So that's been the highlight, I think, of my past month.
Great. And I'm guessing amazing food at the wedding. That was my memory of my trip to Pakistan.
Yeah. Listen, I mean, my poor partner's vegetarian. And so he was struggling, but I had a great time.
Yeah, my memory is really amazing fish and seafood curries. That was a real sort of highlight of the trip. Well, we're glad you're back here. And the first story you've picked out for us this weekend is one involving a certain app.
That's right. My favorite app, even though I like to pretend that I don't spend as much time on my phone as I actually do, TikTok. So US lawmakers have a bipartisan approach, actually, to banning TikTok. And TikTok has, the US lawmakers have been attempting to sort of ban or restrict TikTok for a number of years now. So this is another attempt. But the difference this time is that it's bipartisan. It also has the support of the White House, with security officials from the White House involved in the drafting of this legislation. And what the US Congressional Committee has passed a bill that would remove TikTok from the app stores unless its Chinese owner ByteDance divests the video sharing platform. And this came, the passing came despite quite a lot of lobbying from TikTok users themselves. And what was quite interesting is that TikTok users in the United States, when they opened the app, they would be presented with a pop-up that said, you know, your government is trying to ban this app, so please call your congressional representative immediately. And they were even given sort of the local codes and so on. And so the floors were inundated with calls from users. But still, despite that, the bill went ahead. And so it'll be interesting to see whether or not it'll pass the Senate. Of course, the real challenge, though, is the freedom of speech element to it. Like, how can lawyers are essentially saying it will be, yes, you sort of have the national security concern, but on the other hand, an app that is about freedom of speech and expression fundamentally is going to be very challenging to get through.
Just to unpack some of that, I mean, it really is a case study in the law of inverse consequences, because what congressional staff are saying is that this was an inundation of calls and that they were incredibly angry, particularly, it says, from middle-aged women, which I didn't think would be the kind of main demographic from TikTok. But they say that's actually hardened their position, not helped TikTok's cause.
Yeah, it is quite interesting to see when you sort of poke at what people find really important. And I think the communities that have been built around TikTok are not only the sort of young people dancing that people might have had in their minds, you know, from 5 years ago or so. You've got lots of different communities that have found a place on TikTok and also see the involvement of the government trying to ban the app as encroaching on their freedom of speech. And so it is perhaps maybe surprising for those who are not on the platform, but I would definitely say that the range of people using the platform and also the range of people being able to monetize the platform for themselves, sell products on the platform and so on, is much broader than one would expect. But of course, with that congressional, with the sort of lobbying from your average user, it almost kind of reinforces the US government's position that, hey, actually, this app has a way of influencing users in at a mass scale.
To sort of put the security perspective on this, though, there really is no such thing in China as a company that's not under state control, under the Chinese Conservative Party. And there are concerns about the way it is shaping particularly young people's view of world events and what it could do in future. To sort of put an example I sort of think about is, imagine at the height of the Cold War, if the USSR had sent every American home a television set and they controlled the channels that were on it, would America simply accept that that was okay? So when it comes to, you know, TikTok, there are possibly real concerns that you're allowing a foreign government, potentially using algorithms which are unseen, to sort of break apart your broadcasting ecosystem and guide, you know, coverage of world events and events in the US in the way that China wants them to be seen.
Yeah, it's a fascinating sort of case study in this, because, of course, the United States is comfortable with American platforms, social media platforms being, you know, the sort of global platforms, but much less comfortable with it the other way around, right? And it is true. I think there is no, we understand there is no major company that can operate without the influence of the Chinese state. And there are reports that TikTok has been used to, you know, gain information on journalists and so on. So it is, it's not a conspiracy theory. I think sometimes it can kind of, we might talk about it and it sounds a little bit like conspiracy, but it isn't really conspiracy. What we're talking about is, how do we navigate these ideas of, you know, nation state and national security in a time when the platforms we use are completely globalized? I think maybe the difference is, I'd be curious as to whether, you know, like, if this was a Russia example, I would believe that I would understand that Russia would be much more interested in just fostering chaos, right? Because that's kind of how that state operates. It is less clear to me what the Chinese state might be kind of, what position they might be pushing apart from wanting to sort of maintain things domestically. So that's also interesting. Would the danger be about influencing domestic policy, like with the Russian state, or would it be actually much more sort of inward looking? That the Chinese state, I think, operates a bit differently.
I do have to say, I have come across an expression recently with social media use that I think originated from TikTok, which I do love, which is you need to go outside and touch some grass.
Oh, yes.
I do feel like I have never engaged in TikTok because I'm like, I'm on social media enough. On Instagram is my like little last refuge of social media, and I already think I overuse that. So I think, you know, it is, touch some grass, as the kids say. It's a great expression. Into orbit and a story about space.
That's right. So what I love are dramatic fights within space and physics communities that are very, very important to people within the world of within that academic realm, but completely separate from the rest of our world. And this is one of them, because listeners might have heard of the idea of dark matter. Dark matter is something that scientists have said has existed in the universe for decades, or for a long time, but they've never been able to see it. They've never been able to measure it, but they believe that it's out there. Mm. Well, now it's supposed to account for 80% actually of the mass of the universe. But there is a new proposition outlined in a new paper that says space-time is actually just wobbly and there is no such thing as dark matter, which is, you know, a pretty dramatic statement to make. And the way that I understand it is, rather than dark matter existing, what the writers of the paper are proposing is that space-time kind of operates, you know, mostly smoothly, but then sometimes there are sort of warbles or like a bubbling of a stream. And that bubbling is what gives, you know, the effect of dark matter. But actually, it's just the sort of the shape.
So it's
of,
like the ripples.
Right, exactly. In the space-time fabric, I guess you could say. But of course, that's a pretty dramatic thing to say, because it also completely changes the way that scientists approach the study of space.
And because they think it makes up 85% of the mass in the universe.
Right. Loads. Huge. That's the majority of the mass. And what I love as well is the academic sort of sparring, because there are some theorists. So Professor Carlo Rovelli and Jeff Pennington have signed a 5,000-to-1 odds bet with Oppenheim against his theory being proven correct. So I mean, imagine you put something out in the world and, you know, other professors in your area are like 5,000-to-1, you're wrong, because their position is like, essentially they were like, it's very nice that you're exploring a wide variety of theories, but we think you're completely wrong. I have no idea what the impact of this spa will be, but I think it's fascinating. I think also, you know, we often think about, or when we often speak about history and the history of science and so on, we think, oh, there was a time when people thought the sun revolved around the earth, and oh, there was a time when people believed one thing really deeply, but how ridiculous. And actually, we are kind of living through that sort of time. We believe that dark matter is real.
Mm. Well, a movie about physics will be taking center stage in Los Angeles tomorrow. That is, of course, Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. This year's Film Awards season is culminating with the 96th Academy Awards ceremony taking place in Hollywood's Dolby Theater. To look ahead at this year's Oscars, Monocle's Thomas Lewis spoke to Bill Kramer, CEO of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, who began by telling us how the final stretch before Sunday's awards ceremony was taking shape.
And this envelope is one name. And the Oscar goes to.
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 My name is Bill Kramer. I'm the CEO of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. It has been an incredible year for cinema, 2023. We saw incredible performances, amazing work across disciplines, big box office films, Barbie, Oppenheimer, intimate movies, past lives, great international cinema, Anatomy of a Fall, Zone of Interest. For the fourth time, there's no one better to lead us through the show. He's an incredible host.
It was a very good year for movies. Business is booming. I know people like to debate now which is better, movies or TV. But here's the thing. No matter how good a show is, there are some things movies could do that TV just can't. For example, a TV show can't lose $100 million. Is the gang from Babylon here? They know. I was just asking if they were here. I was welcoming them.
Is it an energizing time or is it a tiring time? Or it must be pretty exhausting, but I guess that's not always a sort of bad thing. But I just wonder how these periods kind of are in the lead up to the ceremony each year, how energizing they are for you.
Yeah, and I mean, none of this exhausts me. It's thrilling. It's exhilarating. I feel like the industry, the filmmaking community is all sort of moving towards the Oscars throughout the year. So this is a big night for everybody, for nominees, for our Academy members, for our Board of Governors, for the global film community, for the global community of film lovers. So we have a great responsibility with the show, and it's extremely exciting. We have great producers this year, Raj Kapoor, Katie Mullen, Molly McNerney. It's a great group of creative professionals who are using their ample skills to create a night that's going to be unforgettable. So all of this is a great joy for me and for all of our team members at the Academy who are working on this.
I wonder, obviously, some of the big talking points that of the nominees this year, the first Native American actress to be nominated in the Best Actress category, but also sort of conversations about, you know, omissions in that category, Margot Robbie, Greta Gerwig. You know, does it ever frustrate you that, you know, obviously your Academy members are tasked with making these choices each year? That's their role, your job. But if like a headline then sort of, you know, is then taken and that becomes the story, is that ever frustrating for you, or these sort of conversations ones that at the end of the day actually are kind of speak to the films themselves or speak to kind of what people want to get out of the movie going experience? I just wonder from your perspective whether there are any frustrations there just with this year as an example.
Well, starting with the nominations for this year, it is an incredibly diverse slate. You mentioned Lily Gladstone, the first Native American nominated in that category. You know, Coleman and Jody, queer actors playing queer roles, that's huge. This is progress. So we are so, so proud of that great international representation across many categories, even beyond the international feature film category. So we're really proud of the nominations this year. We're a nonprofit arts organization. The Academy sits really in two communities, the film community and the nonprofit arts and culture sector. And both are going through radical business model shifts right now. What that means is, as an organization, we need to evolve. We need to diversify our base of support. We need to think about growing our stakeholders in very appropriate and global ways. So we're constantly thinking about how we evolve as an organization. We don't take anything for granted. And we're constantly working with our members and our Board of Governors to think about where the Academy is going. So there's really no sense of inertia. And there's a lot of great energy around the evolution of the Academy. And we are, I think, beautifully positioned to evolve as we move towards our 100th Oscars in 2028.
The first time I didn't feel it, but this time I feel it, and I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
And I don't think that this means that I am somebody, but I guess I'm on my way. Thank you.
I just said to Matt, losing would suck and winning would be really scary, and it's really, really scary.
Oh, thank you so much, Lady Gaga. Oh.
Let's be honest, we've all practiced that Oscars acceptance speech in the mirror, haven't we, at some point? Well, that was Bill Kramer, CEO of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences there, speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis ahead of this Sunday's ceremony in Hollywood. You can read more of Bill Kramer's insights in this Saturday's edition of the Monocle Minute, and we'll have full reactions to the results for you across our programmes on Monday. Now, Yasmin, what are your predictions? What films have stood out for you this year?
Well, obviously, everyone's talking about Oppenheimer, which was, you know, the big classic. I really hope that Lily Gladstone, who was the Native American woman in Killers of a Flower Moon, I thought she was fantastic. I mean, I tend to be terrible at making predictions, so I'm kind of worried that if I make any kind of prediction, I'll probably just jinx it for whoever's involved. Yeah. I do think, I mean, Christopher Nolan, bless him, he's really been, I was shocked actually that he hadn't received, when I read that he hadn't received an Oscar yet.
Yes,
I was like, maybe
obviously his films have, but he himself
has not. For Best Director or so on. So I think there was similar with the BAFTAs this year, that I think it was his first personal kind of BAFTA. So, you know, the guy's been doing it for a while, so I hope that he gets the gong that that he deserves.
Yeah, I think it's going to sweep the board. A film that I would highly recommend, which I think is nominated in a couple of categories, but I don't think will win, is Past Lives, Celine Song's lovely. If you're a kind of millennial in your mid-30s, it times perfectly with the course of your life. Just hearing that old Skype noise absolutely, like, throws you back in time. It is absolutely fantastic. Well, also in the calendar is this year's London Book Fair, which starts on the 12th of March. Joining me now to tell us more is director of the London Book Fair, Gareth Rapley. Gareth, thank you so much for coming on the show. Tell us a bit about this year's fair.
Hi, yeah, good morning. Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be able to speak with you and your listeners this morning. This year's fair is promising to be another great one. So much activities, content, and engagements going on across the 3 days, but also across the week. I think there's many other things happening across the City of London, from breakfast meetings through to evening receptions while LBF takes place. And this year we've got some great headline speakers, really focusing on some big topics like accessibility, diversity and inclusion, through to things like mental health, copyright, which is really a big area of discussion across the industry at the moment. And I think for many, as we look towards areas like artificial intelligence coming more to the fore at the moment.
Just to go into some of that, I mean, accessibility, if someone's listening to this and they've never been to a book fair, but they love reading, why should they go along to one? What can they experience at yours?
London Book Fair, I think, first and foremost, is really a trade fair in essence. So at the very heart of what is happening over the next week is about those rights and license deals that are taking place. And that could be a new title, the next big bestseller that's about to come in the next few years, or an existing book that's being adapted into screen, or something like, you know, we have many international participation coming into the fair, and they'll be dealing with maybe, you know, translation from like a Japanese market, an Indian writer, right across to maybe South American, you know, some of those writers in Brazil. So what you've got in essence is a great showcase of some of the world's biggest publishers, right through to small independent publishers and solution providers that have things like technology, subscription services, like an Audible, Spotify, right through to things like our literary agents and scouts from around the world.
And, you know, you mentioned there one particular issue which there's going to be lots of discussion of, and it's AI and copyright. I mean, you've had a lot of experience across sectors. How transformative do you think this is going to be? And can it be used in a positive way at all?
I would like to believe yes. I think my own humble opinion, I think you have to break AI down into two components. I think one component is the copyright issue, and that is a big issue. And authors and creative writers shouldn't be stifled or not compensated for fair use of their work. So I think there's lots of dialogue going on with relevant governments and institutions to ensure that that protection is in place and there isn't effectively that AI being used to take their copyright and enable others and then they're not being fairly compensated. So I think you've got that side of the issue, and that needs to be addressed. And those creative writers and authors need to be protected in that way. But I think you've then got the other side of it, which is the technology piece. And as we've seen for many years now, technology is developed at a rapid rate, and I think has done lots of great things to enhance the ways we work, the ways we live our life. And I think that should be no different to what's happening within the book and publishing industry, being able to use data to kind of get greater insights about what's happening, become more efficient, and potentially make some things more accessible and or more readily available. So I think if you break them down onto those two sides, then that for me would be the best way that protection, but leverage the technology in the right ways and at the right times.
And just finally, looking at the global book market, I mean, last year, more than a billion books were printed and bought, it is thought. And the huge market for translation fiction grew 11%. There's always concerns that particularly young people don't read enough. But it does seem like it's in a sort of robust health at the moment, doesn't it?
I think so. I think all the statistics point to that. I know there are some challenges. We've just had World Book Day this week, really kind of highlighting that reading for pleasure. And it's something we're going to be having a discussion on with people like Cassie Chatterton, the head of World Book Day, during the program itself. But I think what you can never take away in parts of this, I look upon myself as a father of three children, is that immersive engagement that you can have with a printed book and your children, teaching them literacy skills, having that kind of parent-child bonding moment as well, and being able to explain things. So I think book sales continue to be robust, as we can see from the data, and diverse. And I think it's great to see those translation numbers as well. Very important, because I think this is what books have the power to do, is help to inform, educate, and create great creativity, learning, opportunities for the next generation.
Gareth, thank you. That was Gareth Rapley, the director of the London Book Fair. Still with us is Yasmin Abdel-Majid, herself an author, so she's a world that she knows a lot about. But something else very close to your heart is Sudan, and there's been some developments this week.
That's right. So the United Nations Security Council has adopted a resolution with 14 votes in favour and one abstention, which was Russia, calling on all parties of the conflict to end hostilities, so a ceasefire, during the month of Ramadan. And I mean, this is a positive step in one sense, because people have been pushing for the Security Council to actually, you know, demonstrate a commitment to the ceasefire and so on. Whether or not it will have an impact on the ground remains to be seen, partly because there has been very little incentive throughout the past almost year now of the war for the belligerents in charge of the two sides, as it were, of the conflict, to cease hostilities. I think the international community has largely ignored the conflict. We heard most of the news about the conflict was about evacuating foreign citizens in April and May of last year. But since then, it's generally been a war that's kind of been under the radar. But it's now reached a point where we're looking at an incredible catastrophe looming. We've got 18 million people plus who are facing acute hunger. It is at the catastrophic levels. I think 25 million people in the country, so about one in every two, require aid. And the request from the United Nations for support has been about $4 billion, and only about 4% of that has been funded. So I think, yes, it's positive that this resolution has been, you know, voted for, but it remains to be seen whether this will have a tangible impact. And of course, you know, this comes at a time when ceasefires are on the agenda. We're looking also at ceasefire in Gaza, being attempted, being pushed for. And just saw another headline saying Joe Biden says it's going to be tough to get a ceasefire in Ramadan for Gaza. So I think it's unfortunate that there are a number of places around the world where there are hundreds of thousands, millions of people facing starvation, facing, you know, war crimes and so on. And you know, you want the United Nations Security Council motions to have an impact, but there is the question of how much impact they actually do have on the ground.
And I know I've seen on social media, on Instagram, not on TikTok, but anyway, big on there, that you talk about Sudan a lot to try and highlight it. Because as you say, with everything going on in the world, it's not getting the attention it did, say, 2 decades ago with the situation in Darfur. If anyone listening to this wants to read in more to this, aside from following you on platforms and reading your reporting, who should they be reading to get an understanding of this situation?
So I edit a site called eyesonsudan.net, which is a hub really for information on Sudan and on the current conflict. We began it a few years ago when there was a telecommunications blackout and information was very difficult to find. So if people head to eyesonsudan.net, you can access lots of different reading, look at places that you can donate to, etc. So that's what I would recommend.
Yasmin, thank you so much for keeping us all company this morning. That is Monocle on Saturday. My thanks to our producer and studio engineer, Mariella Bevan, and our researcher, Nyoma Ekwe. My guest, as I said, was Yasmin Abdel-Majid and Gareth Rapley from the London Book Fair 2. Monocle on Saturday returns next weekend. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.